Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 19. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. This is an exciting episode because it's the first in which I get to thank three wonderful patrons who've very generously chosen to support this podcast. So a very hearty thank you to Andy, Joanna and Christina. I can't even begin to tell you how much your support means to me. Despite the fact that I absolutely love what I do, it takes a lot of time and energy, not to mention quite a bit of money, to research, produce, and host this podcast. So if you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, I'd be most grateful. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me today to talk all things Thomas and George Boleyn is Dr. Lauren Mackay. Dr. Mackay is an historian whose focus of study goes beyond familiar historical figures and events to lesser-known individuals, as well as beliefs, customs, and diplomacy of the 16th century. My conversation with Lauren straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song Born to Be Your Queen is from the Ballad of Anne Boleyn, Carlene's best-selling album inspired by the life of Henry VIII's second queen consort, Anne Boleyn.
Make me your wife, your one and only. I'll give you everything you need. I'll give you sons, I'll give you glory, for I was born to be your queen. When they refuse and they oppose you, remember God is in your ear. You are the king and you must tell them true that I was born to be your queen.
Sorry.
ring the bells this coronation day. Just wait and see what I can be. The history books will celebrate my name. Oh, Anne Boleyn, England's queen.
Welcome to Talking Tudors, Lauren. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you? It's great to talk to another Australian. Not that I don't, but, you know, particular Australian.
Yeah, it's lovely to have another fellow Aussie on the show. Now, I thought we'd begin, obviously you and I have known each other for quite some time, but I thought if you could tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and your background and maybe what, how an Aussie, like me, got to love the Tudors.
I guess it's less rare than we think.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'm from, obviously, Sydney, Australia. I can actually hear my Australian accent coming out just a little bit now, which is always fun. I was actually a classically trained violinist to begin with. I've been playing violin since the age of 4. I studied at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. But I was actually originally into ancient history. That was my first love, ancient Egypt.
Right.
And I gave up trying to do it too much because I realized from about, I don't know, 12 years old that I had to learn ancient Egyptian, which was going to be tricky, and to a lesser extent German, which was also going to be tricky because a lot of the secondary sources are in German. So I just thought, you know what, I'll do something else. It's fine. But I actually came to the Tudor period through my music to begin with, because at the conservatorium we studied various periods of styles of music, and medieval had always been just one of the most fascinating musical periods, and I loved the music, so I kind of came to gradually the Tudor period, but it also kind of just came out of nowhere when I went to see I hope no one judges me for this, but the movie Elizabeth in 1998. Yeah. And I, even though, you know, and I saw it with my mother, and I just remembered this one outburst that Kathy, what was her name? Whoever plays Mary, Queen Mary.
Yeah, I can't remember.
She sort of explodes, and she says, you know, my sister was born of that whore Anne Boleyn.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And that was the very first, I'm sorry if I just swore on the podcast.
Okay.
But I just remembered that line, and I had no idea who Anne Boleyn was, but there was just something about the name that I don't know, at first it conjured up this kind of blonde, I don't know why, maybe because I was 11 or something, but I just thought kind of blonde, dark brown eyes, and very kind of calm, and I don't know, this sort of very, very sort of put together woman, and I just thought, I really want to know more about this woman. Mm. And then, of course, I started reading, and I just thought, oh, well, okay, she's completely, completely different from what I thought she would be. But that was really what started, and I haven't looked back. I've certainly watched that movie many more times, but it hasn't had the same impact. But, it just kind of exploded from there.
Fabulous. Love it. Now, I have just finished reading your excellent biography of Thomas and George Boleyn, which is called Among the Wolves of Court. That's my first read for the year, and what a way to start. Yeah. It's a tremendous book. Congratulations, Lauren. It's fabulous.
Thank you.
So what drew you to Thomas and George's story?
From the very first moment I started reading about Anne Boleyn, you come across these names, these sort of the chorus in her story, and certainly Thomas Boleyn. But I think it was when I first read that letter that Anne Boleyn writes to her father, and it's from, you know, Margaret of Austria's court. And we always just tend to sort of look at Anne and what she's saying, and the nature of the letter and what it might say about her. Mm-hmm. And then I think, I don't know, this must have been a good 10 years ago, I suddenly sort of thought, well, wait a minute, what kind of man, like, who is she actually writing to? You know, if she's saying these things, I mean, she clearly adores the person she's writing to. She thinks the world of this person, of her father. Mm-hmm. So what does this tell us about Thomas Boleyn? Because I know what fiction tells us, and I know what historians tell us, and everyone sort of rolls out the same criticisms, you know, sacrificed his daughters to the bedchamber, greedy, grasping, all of that.
Yeah.
And I thought, but there must be something more to this man. And I thought perhaps no one had ever really written about Thomas and George because there was, a lack of sources. Mm. But then, of course, I went to the actual letters and papers and the state papers, and I realized, oh, no, there's actually quite a wealth of information here. And, you know, the real Thomas Boleyn and the real George Boleyn have been under our noses this whole time for centuries, but we haven't turned to look at them. We've always just been so distracted by Anne Boleyn and Absolutely, so entranced by her that we have exactly. And I think that's, you know, it's hard to compete. And it's interesting because, you know, when we look at sort of, I guess, you know, gender history, for example, we're looking at the new approaches to reading history. Mm. You know, Anne Boleyn and Thomas Boleyn, they're very peculiar because here you have Thomas, who is a male in a dominated and a male dominated society, being eclipsed by his female relative. It's peculiar. I mean, how can you not think that's interesting? So that was what really drew me to them, and I at the moment I started reading about their lives, I realized, okay, there's a story here. These lives have to be rehabilitated because we have done them a great disservice over the centuries.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you've been very successful in doing that. You've touched on this a little bit, that popular history sort of tells us that Thomas was only motivated by self-interest and ambition and that he cared very little, obviously, for the welfare of his children. But this isn't the Thomas that you so beautifully bring to life in your book. And I'd love to hear more, and I think other people would love to hear more, about the man that you actually found or discovered in your research. What was he actually like? What did his contemporaries actually think of him?
Yeah, it's unfortunate because as I write in the book, you know, they have been captive to this dated narrative. It's so unfortunate. Historians and historical fiction, they are kind of portrayed as the wolves of court, and so they obviously haven't fared well in the hands of history. But, you know, the real Thomas Boleyn that comes through the sources, he was educated, he was intelligent, he was a gifted ambassador and statesman, he was loyal, and I think that's what people probably don't really see. He was dedicated to his family, absolutely. He was dedicated to his wife, his daughters, his son, absolutely dedicated to his mother. I mean, the letters between he and his mother are extraordinary in what they sort of reveal about this relationship. He's the eldest of her children, and the eldest son, the firstborn. And after his father dies, William, he takes over the family. Mm-hmm. And it's not to propel them into court and to, you know, and to sort of get that ball rolling. He wants to improve upon his family's standing. This is a close-knit family intent on bettering themselves with each generation. That's exactly what Thomas Boleyn sets out to do. Now, what other people thought of him, that's really interesting, because actually he was one of the most respected ambassadors of the Tudor period. He had amazing relationships with Margaret of Austria, who is not a woman easily impressed. Mm. And by the end of his very first embassy with her, I mean, she quite adored him. They had an incredible relationship, and he managed to have this kind of, I guess I would call it personality politics, and it's quite a skill that he has of endearing himself, ingratiating himself. It's not false, it is real, it's just a skill I think that a lot of ambassadors have now and politicians have today as well. You find something in common and you connect over that. Now, he does that with Francis the First and his mother, Louisa of Savoy, Marguerite of Navarre, his sister. They adore Thomas Boleyn as well. Queen Claude adored Thomas Boleyn. And then we come back to the Tudor court. In fact, even Charles V quite liked Thomas Boleyn until, you know, things got a little bit awkward.
A little bit hairy.
Just a little bit, but he really did respect him. He even wrote to Thomas Boleyn personally, which is so rarely seen. You don't really see a foreign monarch write to a foreign ambassador. It's quite rare. But Thomas Boleyn had this kind of brief correspondence with Charles V later on in his career. But, you know, Cardinal Wolsey relied on Thomas very, very heavily. They had a great professional relationship. Thomas Cromwell had a great professional relationship with Thomas for some time. Got a little bit hairy as well, of course. But I suppose the most interesting thing, I guess, about, you know, in terms of Thomas's relationships is, of course, his relationship with Desiderius Erasmus. You know, Erasmus, the great humanist, the great scholar of the age, who, you know, whose friendship with More has kind of propelled More into this, you know, these higher echelons of scholarly society, if you will, and yet he is someone like Erasmus saying of Thomas Boleyn, this is one of the most learned men I've ever met. And you can see the respect between them in their correspondence, which, again, we don't really consider. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, I know what historians have said about how, you know, Thomas's contemporaries viewed him. I always think about Charles Brandon in The Tudors saying, tell me, Boleyn, was it all worth it?
That's right.
Come on, Charles. But apart from that, I mean, obviously, you know, there is much more to the story. It's not as simplistic as that.
No, yeah, absolutely. And you've obviously been touching on the fact that Thomas had forged a really successful career at court long before kind of Mary or Anne ever caught Henry's eye, which is, I think lots of people sort of think that his success came from them, and obviously you've proven that that's not correct. He was very successful. What were some of the highlights of his early career?
His career, of course, spanned over 3 decades. So Henry VII and Henry VIII, in case anyone's wondering. It really did get off to a roaring start decades prior. The highlights, my gosh, Margaret of Austria's court, that very first embassy, I think, was extraordinary for Thomas, because here he is being singled out. He has no experience in ambassadorial statecraft whatsoever. He's about 35, but he's still younger than the other ambassadors who were chosen to go with him, John Young, Richard Wingfield. So they're the more experienced crew. And he goes, and over the course of, I think, I don't know, 10 months or so, I mean, he just becomes the star of this embassy. So I think that really says a lot about the kind of, this guy knows an opportunity when he sees it, and he is able to sort of turn a situation and suddenly become the most integral person in that embassy.
Yeah.
I think that's extraordinary. But I think also another highlight would be, when we look at the field of cloth of gold, I mean, that is the most famous Anglo-French summit, I think, in history, I guess. And in 1520, we don't really consider the months of planning that went into that event, and I don't think we really associate Thomas Boleyn with that event, apart from maybe participating. But he spent, as an ambassador in France, working for Wolsey, working as one of Wolsey's right-hand men, I should add. He spent months negotiating the field of cloth of gold. He was negotiating with Louise of Savoy and Wolsey. Where are we going to hold it? Louise wants to hold it here. Henry wants to hold it here. Thomas is even sort of responsible for insisting that it's held in June rather than July, because he wrote to Wolsey that he was worried that in July it was the hottest month of the year. People would drink more. Wolves would break out. So, I mean, he's conscientious as well. He's thinking ahead. I like that about him. So certainly these are some of the highlights of his early career. This is all, long before Anne even comes onto the scene. But certainly, even in, his French, and then his French embassy a little bit later, he has, of course, the embassy to Charles V. So he's out there. These are some of the highlights of his career, when he is absolutely integral to Anglo-imperial negotiations and Anglo-French negotiations. He's, he's definitely one of the most important ambassadors during those years.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I absolutely loved reading about all that time that you wrote about his, career as an ambassador. It was amazing. I also loved something else that I really loved was reading about Thomas's relationship with his godson. Now, I don't think this is something you hear about often at all. Now, Thomas Tebbold, is it? I think I always pronounce things incorrectly. So Thomas Tebbold, I'll just say it like that. Could you tell us a little bit about this bond, this amazing bond that these two men shared?
Yeah, it's interesting, because some historians have actually said that Thomas... Yeah, we'll go with Tebbold. I just say Tebbold too. I don't know. Yeah, it's good. Choose your own adventure with these kinds of things.
Exactly.
But it's interesting, because some historians have actually erroneously called him Thomas Cromwell's godson. So I don't know how that kind of got mixed up.
Okay.
Everyone is just always ready to take something away from Thomas Boleyn. It astounds me. No, but their relationship is there's a little bit of mystery about it, because we have Thomas Tebbold's letters to his godfather, Thomas Boleyn, but we don't have Thomas Boleyn's letters back to Thomas Tebbold. Obviously, this is a young man who doesn't really have an eye to posterity and doesn't keep these letters.
Right,
I would love to know, but obviously... We do know that, I think, Thomas Tebbold was the son of one of Boleyn's stewards at Hever. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a lasting relationship. I think that's right. And I think Thomas doted on this young man, from what we can tell. Of all the letters of Thomas's life, these are actually one of the few personal examples of correspondence we have. And it's such a shame we don't have them between Thomas and his son George, but you have to make do with Thomas Tebbold. But I mean, these letters from Tebbold to Thomas Boleyn, some of which are damaged, I would call actually most of them are damaged, but they're very, very warm, they're detailed, they're deferential, and they demonstrate this incredibly close nature. You know, Thomas Thibault writes to his godfather, you know, thanks, as I guess as any student does, thanks for the money, I really needed it, and I bought a lot of books, and I'm definitely like working on my Latin, as you said.
I love that, that's so good.
You know, I know, and it's so extraordinary. But then, of course, it's interesting because Thomas Thibault then, as he gets older, he then starts to really sort of work with his godfather, Thomas. So he's, you know, he's kind of an almost like a little agent going throughout Europe. He goes to the Frankfurt Buchmesse on behalf of Thomas Boleyn. So he's really, really, really active in the political scene as well. And, of course, I actually believe, because Thomas Thibault later became Thomas Cromwell's, one of his agents, I believe that Thomas Boleyn introduced him to Cromwell. And that's just a small part of a very interesting relationship between Cromwell and Boleyn, as obviously you would have read. So definitely he's promoting his godson. He doesn't have to do any of this, but he is obviously extraordinarily close to him. And even after, of course, the events of 1536, you know, in the last months of Thomas Boleyn's life, you know, his godson is right. You can almost read the concern his godson has for him. He's trying to keep his spirits up. He's writing to him. He's, you know, saying, yes, I'm doing as you have advised. I'm doing this. You know, my French is still pretty bad. Sorry, you know, I'm not like you, but it's very, very interesting. It just really shows that Thomas Boleyn wanted this young man who probably wouldn't have had such opportunities otherwise, to establish a network, to have this education, to hone his linguistic skills in French and Latin, seek out learned men. You know, these are highly valuable correspondence between these two men, and I think it really does deserve far more consideration than it's ever received. Yeah. But certainly, I guess, and this kind of relationship just makes it all the more poignant that, you know, the lack of evidence between Thomas and his own son. But I think we can kind of imagine that, you know, if this is how close he is to his godson, this is what he would do for his godson, what would he do for his own children?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was thinking. And it just makes him so much more human, doesn't it? We don't often get snippets of that sort of human side to him. And
he sounds a little bit like a nag, like a little bit like a nagging godfather. don't spend that money
don't
on
waste
ale.
That money. Yeah, that's right. I know. I loved it. That was really a highlight of the book, I think. And like, what about George Boleyn? Let's talk about George, Lauren. It seems to me, as I was reading the book, I just felt that he was never really taken as seriously as his father, and that this caused him quite a lot of frustration. So what do we know about George's character?
You know, it's interesting because you have in the history books, there's always the, you know, George was very, very confident, bordering on arrogant, and somehow that he was almost immediately successful as an ambassador. But that's not quite the case. I think we have to understand the context as well of, you know, his very first years as an ambassador. Mm. You know, he's not just appointed, you know, because he's on the rise or anything like that. He's appointed, of course, because he is the brother of the queen-to-be.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, and which is really unfortunate, because I think this really hinders him for the rest of his, it shackles him to Anne and Henry's, which means I don't think we ever really get a sense almost of George's true potential.
Yeah.
So when we talk about George being an ambassador, I think George, by the end of it, would probably say he felt more like a glorified messenger because he's only ever dispatched to the French court. And when we look at the traditional method of diplomacy, we look at resident ambassadors and special envoys. Those are the two main branches. Mm-hmm. Resident ambassadors, of course, Thomas Boleyn was one. He spent, you know, months to years at one court. That's the norm. Special envoys go over for a particular point, but usually to sort of negotiate a treaty or something along those lines, and they stay there for the duration of that issue until it's resolved. Or not, or they'll go to war, depending on what happens.
Yeah.
But George was kind of neither. He was there at the French court to always bolster support for his sister and for Henry. And I just feel like what a missed opportunity for this young man. And I feel there's just this sense of a missed opportunity. You know, he's finally at the age where he should be going out and following in his father's footsteps. And here he is dealing with probably an issue that never seems to resolve itself. Even by 1535, you know, in his last embassies, he's still trying to sort out this problem about, you know, recognizing his sister's marriage. It's very, very unfortunate. I think that you can really feel in the sources of what we have that, you know, far from being this kind of arrogant, self-assured, pompous, preening peacock. I'm running out of P words here, but that's how,
that's pretty good.
No, I think I'm on a roll on the blaze of glory. I just feel that there is this frustration that I don't think we really kind of tap into. I think with George, he's very, very hard to read, and that's why, of course, a lot of my book really is about Thomas and less about George, because his career starts very, very, very late. I mean, 1530, is really when it starts to kind of happen for George, and it's over by 1536.
That's right.
He's a hard man. He's a hard man to pin down, and it's very, very unfortunate. I do think that had he lived, I think he would have gone on to be quite an extraordinary ambassador, because he did. At first, he was a little bit shaky in his embassies. He was wrong-footed a few times, and he didn't make this. And certainly, then there weren't mistakes that his father Thomas would have made. But I think that's an interesting. We get this kind of interesting sense of George as just being a little bit impetuous, maybe a little bit like Anne in that way. But I think he was probably looking forward to, you know, embassies, you know, to the imperial court, especially as Charles V and Henry VIII was kind of dancing around each other. I think there was, and it's just that idea, it's that potential unfilled. It's so tragic.
It is. It's such a tragic story, isn't it? Now, you've spoken about Cardinal Wolsey a little bit. Now, again, popular history would have us sort of believe that the Boleyns and Wolsey were enemies from the very beginning. But is this actually an accurate assessment?
No, but, you know, never let a good story get in the way of the truth, I suppose. We have to go back to 1511, 1512, when we're looking at the Holy League against... drawing France against France, and this is when Thomas Boleyn is actually chosen. Now, we don't really give much thought as to why he's chosen, how he's chosen, how does he even become an ambassador in the first place. You don't just sort of put your hand up. It doesn't work that way. By this point, Cardinal Wolsey is working with Richard Fox, who was the sort of chief architect of Henry VII and Henry VIII's diplomacy. So Thomas Boleyn is tapped on the shoulder by Fox and Wolsey for this very first embassy. And obviously he does his job very, very well, because later on, once Fox is sort of out of the picture and Wolsey is now the chief architect, he's tapped on the shoulder over and over again for special embassies, for very, very delicate embassies. But you also see them, you know, we have so many letters between the two that it's actually extraordinary that we have so just disregarded this relationship and actually how well they worked together. Just out of reach, perhaps, is a personal friendship, but certainly there is trust between the two. Thomas Boleyn, you know, he writes to Wolsey about everything that might be going wrong. He's always very anxious to make sure that Wolsey, sees he's doing exactly what he needs to do, and if he's not doing it, you know, is there something else I need to do here? Wolsey writes to Thomas as, you know, he calls him my loving friend.
Yeah.
Which he does to quite a lot of people. He's a smoothie, Cardinal Wolsey, but he doesn't have to. And there is definitely warmth between the two. And even when we look at this, you know, that particular time when allegedly Thomas Boleyn is passed over for the controllership somehow Wolsey wants to keep him away from power. If you actually, a close reading of the original letters between them shows that that's just not the case. Wolsey is arranging his personnel, and he's clearly saying to Thomas, look, the controllership will only be open for a very, very small time. I think we need to bother having you there. Let's just wait until the treasure ship opens up, which it will very, very soon. So he's just kind of being pragmatic, and it's almost like we're reading the story backwards, and that seems to be the problem.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
We know how Wolsey's story ends, and we kind of know where the Boleyns are situated at his end, but there's far more to the story. So actually, I found reading their correspondence and their decades of good working relationship intriguing. Absolutely intriguing. And it says a lot about Wolsey. You know, Wolsey's only a couple, maybe, what, 7 or 8 years older than Thomas. They're not sort of these...
Yeah, that's
you
right.
You know, Thomas... Yeah, it's like we always think of Cardinal Wolsey as
that's really old, yeah. Father. Like, it's so funny,
yeah,
isn't
it? Yeah, but he's not. He's also a young man. Even though he's kind of young and working with Thomas very, very well for a very long time. And I really wanted to bring that out in the book because I just think that is a thread of Thomas Boleyn's life and of Wolsey's life that needed to be restored.
Yeah, I was absolutely fascinated by all of that as well. Now, if you've read, if anyone that's listening has read any books about Anne Boleyn, then I'm sure they've come across an incident that occurred very late in her reign involving the imperial ambassador, Eustace Chapuis, and a certain public acknowledgement. I know you know what I'm talking about, Lauren. However, yes. What we're so often led to believe and what actually seems to have happened are two quite different things. Could you talk to us a little bit about the sort of popular version that we get a lot and then the events that Chapuis actually recounted to Charles V?
Yes. It's interesting because, I mean, again, I think it's that case of reading the story backwards. We know yeah. Anne has only got a couple more months to live, and I think we want there to be some sort of last triumph.
Yes.
And I think also we tend to pit Chapuis against Anne Boleyn so often, which is very, very unfortunate because obviously, as I wrote in my first book, you know, their relationship was a lot more complicated than that. Mm. And there were definitely more nuances to their relationship than simply he hated her and vice versa.
Yeah.
So we have this kind of last Easter in 1536, and there's a buzz in the air. That's the only way I can describe it. And if you read between Chapuis' lines, something is kind of happening, and he knows it as well. Now, when we look at fiction, it's, you know, we have Chapuis sort of being easily manipulated into standing with George Boleyn, and they are right in the path of Anne and Henry VIII when they come down from Mass and they walk out and everyone has to acknowledge them. Mm. And somehow Chapuis is sort of maneuvered into, I don't know, almost...
Yeah, it's almost like tricked, isn't he? Like tricked,
yeah,
kind of.
which is so unfortunate, but almost tricked into standing in front of her. God knows how that happened.
Yeah.
And he has to bow, and then Anne bow, and then Anne returns the respect. Mm-hmm. That's not what happens. God, it makes it good for story, but that's not what Chapuis actually says. Now, we have to read back a little bit in Chapuis' dispatch, because he says, you know, Cromwell, you know, he wants me to meet with Anne. I'd rather not. I'd rather do anything but that.
Yeah.
But then he also says, everybody... He doesn't say there's a buzz in the air, but he sort of says everyone was watching us as we went into Mass to see what kind of mien Anne and I, he doesn't say Anne, he says something else, but mien Anne and I would put on. Now, that suggests that there's an anticipation in the air. Something, you know, something is expected, and I think Chapuis seems to know it, and I don't know why. So it's a little bit unclear as to what really is happening. Now, he does stand with George. He does that all happens. He doesn't object to being moved where the royal couple would pass. I would even say perhaps this isn't the first time he's ever attended Mass with Anne as queen. It could be, and I'm just putting it out there because I can, I suppose.
Yeah.
He may well have bowed as she walked past before. I mean, he's never bowed to her directly, but certainly just moving for the king and the queen. I don't think you can get away with ever bowing.
No, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
It's what Anne does that's extraordinary. She knows he's there, and obviously, as he says, she turns towards him to return the reverence which I had made her when she passed. So we have to understand. So Chapuis is saying, "I'm already bowing.
Yeah.
This has happened. This is not the great moment. I'm already doing it. It's what she does that is so extraordinary. She turns around. She actually acknowledges my bow. Now, what is that saying? This is a formal recognition. But Anne is turning and showing Chapuis respect, which means she's also signifying that she's showing Charles respect.
That's right.
So it's a lot less dramatic, I suppose, and it's not a victory for Anne, but you know what? It's not a victory for Chapuis either. This is stuff. It's getting real now.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, France is kind of off the table. They're sort of dealing, you know, dather. I don't know what they're. No one even knows what France is doing at this time. They have their own like game or whatever. But for the Anne, I think, and for Henry and for Chapuis, you know, they are already Chapuis and Cromwell have already been talking about an imperial alliance. Catherine of Aragon is dead. There's no reason to fight that battle anymore.
That's right. Yeah.
I think Chapuis is saying, you know what, okay, let's just move on. He's fine, you know, and actually he says to Charles, you know, she was actually quite affable. Mm. He doesn't criticize her. He said, I was surprised she turned around and actually acknowledged my reverence. But this idea that he had to write to Charles and apologize for accidentally bowing to Anne is nonsense, because he obviously makes it very, very clear. He was already bowing, she turns and she makes that play. Mm. And afterwards, she had a desire to actually dine with Chapuis. Chapuis, far from being angry and confused, he goes off to dine with George and Thomas Boleyn.
Right, okay.
So it's, you know, it's interesting how that particular story has been turned to signify something. You know, it's interesting.
It is.
Everyone will agree with me, but I can only present the evidence.
Yeah, no, well, that's fine. Wouldn't you like to be a fly on one of those walls, Lauren? That would have been so cool.
Yes.
So cool to see. Now, as I'm sure all our listeners are well aware, George Boleyn was executed on the 17th of May, 1536, and his sister Anne just 2 days later. Now, their father, Thomas, is often condemned for not having come to the children's aid in their final days and for apparently returning to business pretty quickly soon after. So what do the sources actually tell us about how Thomas conducted himself in the aftermath of the execution of his children?
Well, first and foremost, we have to respect the fact that just because Thomas's children are executed doesn't mean that he suddenly gets to retire.
Mm.
That's not how it happens when you're part of the nobility. You have responsibilities. And Henry just isn't that concerned if you're depressed about it or not. That's not his problem.
If
we look at, you know, it depends on which narrative you want to follow, I suppose, because in some historical fiction, he's sort of he spent the rest of his days a broken man in exile. It's this sort of pathetic view of Thomas Boleyn.
Yeah.
Or there's the other view that he just carried on undeterred by the judicial murder of his children. And I think, as Eric Ives says, he continued to work his way up the greasy pole.
Mm.
Now, that doesn't happen either. He and his wife go to Hever for quite a few months, and they're absolutely, we don't know. They have borne away their grief in the privacy of Hever. Now, the next we kind of hear about Thomas Boleyn is that he has to lend, of course, his garter badge to Thomas Cromwell. Now,
yes,
Thomas Cromwell is inducted into the Order of the Garter. Now, there's this idea that he was only that he offered his garter badge to Cromwell, and, you know, this is his way of ingratiating himself once more. That's not the case. We know, we don't have the letter, but we do know that Henry VIII wrote to Thomas pretty much demanding that he give these garter, but he lend his garter badge to Cromwell, because Thomas makes this very clear in a very kind of terse letter to Cromwell, saying that, all right, here's my garter badge.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently I have to give it to you. Apparently you can't afford your own at this stage. Okay, here's my. And he says this about three times in the letter. I do this only for the king's pleasure.
Mm.
So, you know, there's definitely friction between the two. There's also the fact that, and of course, you know, Thomas Boleyn isn't even, even though he's a member of the Order of the Garter, he does not go to the ceremony to actually induct Cromwell into the order, and he should have been there.
Right.
And I don't know. So I think that says something. He's not going to go and witness Cromwell wearing what was once his.
Yeah.
Then this fact that Cromwell was actually very, very harsh on Thomas Boleyn when it came to the payment of legal subsidies and rents, and he insisted that all of Thomas's payments be paid on time. Now, interestingly, for example, Norfolk was always in arrears. He never paid to Cromwell when he was supposed to. And Cromwell never pushed these kind of repayments, only from Boleyn. He's particularly harsh. Then there's this whole idea, this whole drama between Thomas, the Duke of Norfolk, and Thomas Boleyn, of course, they being brothers-in-law, where Thomas Boleyn's minstrel was caught singing derogatory songs about the Duke of Norfolk.
That kind of made me laugh a bit, though.
And the Duke of Norfolk was so upset.
He was very upset.
So upset. But rather than just sort of deal with Thomas Boleyn, their family, he writes to Cromwell saying, can you talk to Thomas about this? Because I'm upset. And I think that's very, very interesting. I don't know. I think that tells us a great deal about the breakdown in the relationship between Thomas Boleyn and the Duke of Norfolk. I think probably the minstrel came back to Thomas Boleyn and Thomas probably said, you know, next time sing it in French because Norfolk's French is terrible. Probably, I don't know. But he might have. But we don't really know what happened with the minstrel. It kind of goes away. But then we have this idea, of course, that, you know, Thomas Boleyn is then... he's present at the, obviously, at the christening of Jane Seymour's child, Edward.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
As if he's there because he wants to be.
Of course.
He's part of the nobility, and he is absolutely required to be there. It's a cruel gesture on Henry's part, and it says nothing about Thomas Boleyn and everything about Henry, I think.
Absolutely.
And I suppose the other thing, you know, I think he would rather be at Hever by himself in these last years than at court. I don't think he really had any desire to return. But return you have to eventually because, as I said, you have responsibilities and you have duties. And that's, you know, so we have these kind of rumors, oh, they were, you know, Elizabeth and Thomas are back at court and treated well. Mm. Well, I don't know. Well, how else would they be treated? Why would they not be treated well? They are still, you know, upstanding members of the community, I suppose I would say. They have decades of loyalty and dedication and service. Why would they not be treated with anything but respect? So to judge them by, you know, because of the respect that they receive when they return to court is sort of odd. And then, of course, you know, there's this sort of rumor that maybe he was going to marry Margaret Douglas.
Yeah.
The king's niece. That comes from nowhere and it goes nowhere because it is nothing more than a rumor. I mean, Thomas, I think, is on his last legs by this point. I mean, he dies very, very soon after. So I think what's interesting about Thomas's last years is that you just get a sense of a man who just he doesn't want to go back to the life he had. I think he is absolutely devastated by the loss of the loss of his children. Mm. He has a very fractured relationship with Mary Boleyn, but it does seem to mend towards the last years because he does obviously try and provide for her and her and obviously he has a lot of meetings with Mary and her husband William Stafford because we do have evidences that obviously they have met and they have discussed property and certain things. And I think in his last months his real concern is for his mother because, you know, when he dies he's steward Robert Cranwell says, well, we can't move Thomas Boleyn's mother out of Hever because Thomas stipulated long before his death that she was to remain there for the rest of her days and would be able to live the rest of her life there. So, you know, I think Thomas, even in his last years, he really is concerned is for the family that he has. So it's very unfortunate that we have this idea that he's just back at court, you know what, clean slate, let's try this again. He's not. He's writing to his godson. He's at Hever. He's taking care of his wife until she dies. He's taking care of his mother. And then he too passes into fiction is basically what he dies and he passes into fiction.
Yeah, and I don't know this sort of idea that you could just say no to Henry is pretty funny too. It wasn't really that easy.
People really want him to make a stand. But when the King of England wants your children dead, who are you going to complain to?
Yeah,
exactly.
It's such a difficult situation. My goodness.
And
thinking of him at the christening just breaks my heart. I absolutely just think how horrid, like what a horrid thing for him to have to go through. And I was reading actually today or yesterday it was an article about this idea that there is that people in the past didn't love their children in a way as much as we love them today or something like that. And it's just so strange, isn't it? Because of course that connection was there and that love was there. Perhaps it was demonstrated differently. But we know that Elizabeth and Thomas both died within, 2 years or something? One and 2 years of the execution.
You have to look at Anne's letter, though. You know, really have to look at Anne's letter to her father. You can see the love between this young girl and her father. I mean, as I said, she absolutely adores him. There's a formality, but it's that formality of a child really trying to do her best to impress her father. And I think that it's a simplistic notion just to say that the Boleyns didn't love each other when everything Thomas did was for the benefit of his children, not to get them into the royal bedchamber, but to provide them with a life as well and to improve upon even his generation. There was absolutely never intention to make her queen. You know, the education he sought for her was to make her a formidable player in her own right. And I think we have to remember that when passing judgment on what relationship they may have had based on how it ended.
Yeah, and I think it's even more tragic that I think they were a close family. Like, I'm just remembering
Yes.
when Anne was in the tower, she was so concerned for her mother's well-being. Like, her mother's gonna, you know, her heart's gonna be broken when she finds out, and blah blah blah. Like, that doesn't sound like a family that was, you know, distant from one another or didn't
No.
care for each
She
other.
also she's also worried about her father as well. She
Yeah.
wrote, you know, where is your
Yeah,
father, you know,
that's
and
right. Where is he? Yeah, she wanted to know. That's right.
I guess, you know, we judge them for not visiting their children, but again, you know, we have to understand the circumstances. We have to understand the, you know, the what was actually going on. There's no way they could have visited their
No,
children.
no.
You know, there's just no way. So to judge them for these, for the inaction, I think is incredibly disingenuous.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Now, returning for a moment to the kind of macabre topic of executions, in your book, you mentioned something that I've actually never heard before, and I found quite interesting about how the nobility attended executions. Do you think you could just tell our
Well,
listeners a little bit about that?
it comes out of nowhere. Actually, Chapuis is the one who reports. He said this is a new practice that Henry is now sending noblemen to witness executions. Now, it's odd. So, I guess that the first execution that we really hear that people that the nobility are attending would be the execution, the brutal execution of the Carthusian monks.
Oh, yeah.
And Chapuis says, you know, Thomas Boleyn, Norfolk, George, and Henry Fitzroy, Henry VIII's illegitimate son, were present at the executions. And now, it's unclear as to what Henry is either trying. He's trying to make a point, obviously, but I think he was also afraid. Or started to become afraid of what people might start saying before their executions.
Right, yeah.
With the Carthusian monks, one of them actually preached a very fine sermon before he died, and Henry VIII berated Thomas Boleyn for not answering this sermon and standing up. I
Right.
don't think I. And you kind of get a sense that these men don't want to be here, and it's very, very strange because they're present, obviously, but not just that, but I mean, I think he mentions one of them having 40 horse, you know, a train of 40 men with 40 horses,
Right,
which is
okay.
very, very. But they're armed. They have visors on. As Chapuis says, they have visors across their faces. They're mounted on these huge horses. There's something very, very supposedly it's supposed to be intimidating, but also I think it starts to show Henry's fear,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
he's trying to get a grip on everything that's happening. And I think he's sort of losing control a little bit. So it is very macabre, but I don't think the men wanted to be there at all.
Yeah, gosh, it does. It's almost like a reflection of Henry's insecurities that he needed all that, you know,
It is,
going on.
absolutely. It all goes back to Henry eventually.
Gosh, okay. Now, you've obviously been, you know, researching and writing about the Boleyns for quite some time, Thomas and George especially. So, out of all the misconceptions that exist about Thomas
Oh.
and George, what do you think, you know, is the worst, or some of the worst, or the most persistent that you've sort of come across?
Ah, gosh, we could do a whole podcast
Here
on
we
this
go,
because it's
just on the myths and
mind.
the.
Just on the myths. Well, I suppose starting with Thomas, I mean, his idea that he was a pimp. I've
Yeah,
come
yeah.
across that word a lot, and I'm not sure if maybe people not everyone understands what a pimp actually does, but that's not what Thomas Boleyn did. So the idea that he was a pimp, that he sacrificed his daughters to Henry VIII's marital chamber, that he was greedy and grasping and represented all that was bad at the court, that he didn't care about his children's executions, and that he was basically just I know I've come across this a lot online, you know, that he oh my I think some of the worst things I've heard, you know, there's a special place in hell for Thomas Boleyn.
Oh,
I
dear.
don't know why, but certainly I find that very confronting. There's a deep rooted dislike of Thomas Boleyn, and again, and that stems from how Anne was treated. Henry VIII doesn't always sometimes he just gets off scot-free, I
Yeah.
think, with this. But not Thomas Boleyn. So certainly that's one of the misconceptions about Thomas, that he was just that he was a terrible human being and deserve and that he obviously, you know, when you look at him in fiction, that he's sort of ineffectual. He does nothing. He stands around and just looks a little bit smart. I think Hilary Mantel has a Walpole that's horrible. I love her books, but she says about Thomas Boleyn that he's often stroking his beard because he thinks it makes him look enigmatic. But he looks as if he's pleasuring himself, which I thought was such an odd phrase to say. And I thought, gosh, that's so disingenuous towards someone who really had an incredible career and did so much. Now with George, gosh, well, I suppose you know the idea that he was abusive towards his wife Jane, that he and Jane Parker had a horrible relationship. It's just not true. That he was abusive. That he was gay. Obviously, it's not a slander, but it just, you know, it isn't the case with George Clooney. There's no evidence to back that up, and it's, you know, if you're going to construct the person, then construct them correctly, and that's just not who he was. And I suppose that he was pompous and preening, as I said, going back to the P words, that he was arrogant. And again, going back to Wolf Hall, Hilary Mantel has Cromwell ask, "What is the point of George Boleyn?"
Yeah, gosh.
And I think that really just encapsulates. I mean, that sums it up. You know, that what we don't see is, you know, maybe even in George must have to some degree felt that, like, gosh, what can I do? You know, I have to get out there and do something with my career. So it's a very disingenuous statement to make about George. And he can't seem to escape them. Neither of them can. So I'm hoping that the book will allow them to be elevated above these kinds of outdated myths, because they really are, you know, centuries old now. And I think it's time that we have this new idea of actually who they were based on the sources.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we get a bit of a sense of George's courage and his loyalty to his family during the trial, obviously, where he's told not to read out a certain something, and he reads it out anyway. You kind of feel like, oh, yes, good on you, George.
Yes,
like there is, you know, a sense that yes, he was courageous and loyal, of course, and loved his family. So, yeah.
Yes.
All right. Well, while researching your book, I know that, because I saw some pickies, that you had the privilege of handling some pretty amazing Tudor documents. So what were some of your research highlights?
Oh, gosh. I remember being in the Segreto Vatican Archives. They have the Vatican Archives and the Papal Archives next door to each other in Rome. And I was handling Wolsey's letters to the papacy. Mm-hmm. So these are really, really interesting. I have to say just quickly, those archives are crazy because or maybe very Italian, I'm not sure, but there's one room where you have to sit with a pencil and your notebook, and the other room is where the manuscript is. So you have to run back and forth.
Oh my gosh.
And try and remember the information you've just read.
No.
And I remember saying to one of the librarians, I said, "This is ludicrous." I said, "I can't remember what Wolsey's just written, and then I have to go into the other room and write it down." And he just kind of said, "Well, this is the way it is, signorina, and that's the way, you know." And I think I said something like, "Who's in charge of this? The Pope?" And then, of course, there was the, she said the Pope. Anyway, but that was when I got to handle his documents and his seal as well, which was absolutely wonderful. But I also went to the House of Staatsarchiv in Vienna, which is where all of the letters out of England to Charles V, to Margaret of Austria, to Mary of Hungary, that's where they are all kept. So it's the Imperial Archives. Mm. So that's where I got to handle all of Chapuis' documents. They're all in Vienna. But I also got to, you know, read Wolsey's letters to Charles V and to Margaret of Austria, and especially to Charles V, introducing Thomas Boleyn as his resident ambassador. So it was really exciting to see Thomas's name there, you know.
Yeah.
And I suppose, of course, you know, going back to the British Library, which is where most of Thomas's letters are to Cardinal Wolsey and to Cromwell and everyone else. So to actually handle that was really extraordinary. I mean, yeah, I can't really even describe it, but you can just feel the personality on the page, and you're never closer to them as in that moment. And when you examine the documents and you see, like, Thomas Boleyn has sort of crossed out like a couple of words where he's kind of thought, oh, that's a bit too much. I don't mean to say it like
that.
You know, or when Chapuis has knocked over some of his ink or something, he's kind of probably just gone, oh my God, I just almost ruined my letter.
Yeah.
There's no other feeling like it.
Wow, that's amazing. It is those sort of little things that bring them to life, definitely. That's amazing. How wonderful. Now, I know you also have done quite a bit of travel in your research.
Yes.
So what are some of your favourite historic sites to visit associated with Thomas or George? Or both?
In England, obviously, a shout out to Hever. You can't not
say
Hever. But I feel a definite connection to Norfolk because, of course, the Boleyns hailed from Norfolk.
Yep.
And there's a very strong culture there still and feeling about for the Boleyns. So even though Blickling, of course, is no longer the estate that it was, just the ground, because, of course, that's where I think you and I first met, Natalie.
It is.
At Blickling.
Absolutely.
Way back then. in 2000 and something, 2012,
I think. Remember now. Oh, that's right. It was the Berlin Festival. Yeah, that's it.
Exactly.
Goodness.
So, and so you, so as you know, you know, there is that wonderful feeling, that, feeling on the ground. Right. Just on the grounds and on the lovely little church, just, you know, a little bit slightly up from Blickling, where you still have Berlin ancestors.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to go to Seoul.
Oh, gosh.
Seoul is not even a one-horse town. It's not even a one-pub town. It's just a one-church town.
One church.
That's all they have. That's all they have. But what a church.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is huge. And to see Geoffrey Boleyn's tomb and, of course, and Alice, I mean, it was really, really wonderful. So definitely those are the venues. Now, of course, outside England, when I was in Amboise in France, I hadn't really given much thought to the fact that, Thomas Boleyn had actually been at Amboise. He had visited Amboise on numerous occasions. So that was really wonderful to sort of have a European connection with Thomas Boleyn.
Yeah,
but certainly those are some of them, and Penshurst, of course. You know, it's interesting. You know, we don't really think about just because Thomas Boleyn owned Penshurst. You know, we sort of think, well, he probably never visited, but we have a lot of letters that are marked from Penshurst, and he's not just kind of there for a day trip to write a letter. He's definitely staying there, and he's corresponding from there. So I definitely feel a lovely link with Penshurst as well. So kind of Norfolk and Kent are the general areas that I'm very attached to.
Yeah, we don't often. I know we had a little discussion about Penshurst, and I like to, you know, when I go to a place, I like to know, oh, you know, Thomas was here. And I didn't do that last time, so now I have to return so that
nothing
I could go, Thomas was here.
Nothing worse than that missed emotional connection. You
exactly.
Think, oh, that was
my
I know.
It's so frustrating, isn't it? All right, so are you working on any new Tudor books that you can tell us about?
I am working on two books that I've been actually... but I'm not allowed, to tell. Yeah, so my agent will have my head.
Boo, boo. All right. Well, we'll have to update when you can tell us.
Very, very soon. Probably in February, we'll be able to make an announcement. Oh, so it's coming up.
So is this
writing.
All right. So not two simultaneous, but like a two sort of one after the other type thing, or two simultaneous?
It depends on how successful I am with this.
Laura, I take my hat off to you. That's awesome.
Well, now the PhD is done. I've been doing a PhD in books at the same time. So I've got this multitasking thing kind of down
so
pat
you know
now.
How to but
right. Yes, I do. So I mean, it's all happening. They're both coming up pretty well. One will be coming out earlier than the other, of course. But I'll be able to talk about them very soon. But I'm very excited.
All right, good. I can't wait to hear. It's really exciting. Now, we're up to playing our game of 10 to go. Are you ready?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. How random are these going to be? Okay, we'll go. Let's try it.
You'll be fine. I know. All right. Let me see. Where am I going to begin? Oh, let's start easy. What was the last film that you saw?
Oh, my goodness.
Have you watched anything or have you just been working on
this? I have. You know what? Yeah. Do you know what? I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed to say it was Anonymous.
I don't even
know. Which is about, don't watch it, Natalie.
I don't know.
You
have to Google.
It's about Edward, the Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere, and this idea that he may have been responsible for writing
Shakespeare.
Yeah, it is a romp through nonsense. I think it was just after Christmas, and I've never seen it before, and it kind of looked interesting, and then after 10 minutes, I was like, oh. Okay, it's one of these ones. Okay, but it does have Vanessa Redgrave and Jolie Richard, and they are wonderful. So they're the only thing I remember about the movie. The rest I've just blanked and blocked out.
Don't feel bad, Lauren. I just watched Aquaman. So.
Well, I take Aquaman any day.
It was quite interesting to watch. It was entertaining. But okay, moving on. What are two items that are on your bucket list?
Ooh. On my bucket list. Nothing that adventurous, I don't think. I just to tick off as many European countries as I can. Maybe I suppose
that sounds
my
pretty adventurous.
Definitely I don't want to jump out of anything, dive off anything.
No,
dive into anything. Nothing like that. You know, living in Australia, you know, you kind of tick off things like accidentally swimming with sharks off your bucket list. And
it's all by accident, that's the thing.
Exactly. You know, coming face to face with a crocodile, that's it just happens. That kind of thing happens. But certainly, yes, being able to explore. Maybe there would be some archives to actually go to all of the archives throughout Europe that are relevant to the Tudor period. That would be my bucket list. Yeah. I have a few more to tick off that are difficult and... Yes, that would be my bucket list for sure.
All right, sounds cool. What's an
And to learn
early?
to cook certain cakes properly. That would be my bucket list as well.
What was that last one? I heard to bake a cake, but I don't think that's what you said.
I said to be able to bake, so there's really, really fancy cakes that I always see on like Instagram. And maybe, yeah, why not? That can
Why
be my
not?
bucket list as
Why
well.
not? Add it to the
Yeah.
list. That sounds good. All right. What's an early childhood memory that you have?
Going to the library with my father. My dad, we used to have what we called daddy daughter days during the
Oh.
holidays. And it was just a time, it was just a time for us, and we would go to the library, and I would max out at the Sydney City Library, you'd have 10, you'd be able to book 10 books, and
That's
I would max that out every time. So I'd start borrowing his, I'd take his card and maybe take 5 off his limit as well. And that's really one of my first memories, going to the library and reading about ancient Egypt. And then my dad would take me to the Nicholson Museum on the same day, which the Nicholson Museum is part of Sydney University, and they have an extraordinary collection of ancient Egyptian artifacts, and I think ancient Greek as well. And it really, really extraordinary. So I used to, that was the best. I'd always get to buy like a little historical knick-knack or something in the
Oh,
gift
that's
shop.
cute. I love that. That's a really
That's
nice memory.
one of my earliest memories, yes.
Oh, lovely. Now, what about a favorite childhood book?
Ooh, gosh. I mean, I always loved the Terry Pratchett books. That was definitely So I think, I don't know, I think, yes, anything by Terry Pratchett. Maybe like Good Omens was one of my favorite books when I was much younger, which is one he wrote with Neil Gaiman. I just think there's something, just the way that Terry Pratchett wrote, and just his Discworld series was, I mean, they're books that I read when I was much younger that I could still pick up today and read again. So probably anything by Terry Pratchett.
All right, sounds good. Now, staying on the book topic, I imagine you've got lots on your bedside table. What's one of the books you're currently reading?
Well, I've knocked about 1 billion off right now,
Oh.
because I just, well, because I they were all for reading that I had to do, so I've
Right,
now gotten rid of them. I'm still reading Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey right now, which
All
is,
right.
again, I know, keeping you can you just can't get me away from ancient history, even
Even
if I
if you,
try. I still
yeah.
no. The Odyssey, of course, has been written of, obviously it's been translated many, many times. So Emily Wilson's is she's the first female to translate it, and her translation is just so fresh and so modern and so accessible. So I kind of read it before bed to get my head out of what I'm writing, and I absolutely love it.
Fabulous. Sounds good. What's a favorite holiday destination?
Slovenia is one of my favorite
Yes.
holiday destinations, which is where my fiance is from. Not to be confused with Slovakia. In fact, ministers from Slovakia and Slovenia had a conference in London years ago to kind of say, listen, we're different
We're
people and we're
different,
different countries.
different
Please
places.
don't confuse us all the time. Slovenia, because obviously my fiance is from there, but also because Slovenia was part of the Holy Roman Empire. So I actually found letters from Charles V written from what is the capital city, Ljubljana, and he was writing. So I feel an absolute connection to Slovenia. Also, because I also do tours of Slovenia with my fiance, historical tours. But that deals with the wars between the Venetian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and Charles V. And so I love visiting there because it's one of the few places where you can really the castles are so many of them are still intact. The nat it's, you know the environment is amazing. The culture is amazing, and the cities are these lovely little cobblestone,
Oh, it
you know,
sounds
cities that haven't been
beautiful.
touched. Yeah, so that's probably one of my favorite holidays destinations to go to.
Love it. All right, so describe your ideal Saturday night.
Well, like you, Natalie, I think there would be some kind of champagne involved, or
How
at
did
the
you
very least, because I've known you a long time, and I remember you used to. Don't you remember Friday afternoons at the Rocks
Yeah, that
years
was
ago?
lovely. I know you have to come back so
Yeah.
we can
I know
return.
we go way back with our Prosecco.
Yeah, that's
And something definitely something historical on the television, a good documentary, or something that's really, really that's not anonymous, obviously, that's something very, very
Aquaman. Oh, well, maybe
engaging.
Aquaman.
or heaven forbid, Aquaman. And just a quiet Saturday nice. Evening is basically what I yearn for. But just to be able to sort of shut my laptop down, have something that I have either sent in to someone or I have gotten off my plate,
then
to actually just go and be free. That's my ideal Saturday night.
Yeah, that's.
And definitely, great. I can't stress this enough. The champagne has to be somewhere.
Well, I totally agree with you. You don't need to convince me, Lauren. That's fine. I completely agree with you. All right. So what was your first paid job?
My first paid job? It was at Darling Harbour.
Mm-hmm.
No, actually, no, it wasn't that. No, probably, I guess if we're really not going like officially, I was probably putting – my father paid me $2. That was my first official paid job to put addresses on envelopes. Because my father's the president of the Oriental Rug Society of New South Wales. So they have these wonderful, and so he would pay, I mean, kind of slave labor if we're honest, but I mean, that's fine. And so he would pay myself and my brother $2 to stick all the envelopes with addresses onto like literally like 300 envelopes.
Excellent.
And that was my first official paid job.
Yeah, I like it.
He would say that was very, very reasonable. For the time, but I don't think it was
$2. I'm not sure, but it's pretty good. If you're a kid, that's all right. So, what's a really great piece of advice that you've been given? It could be about anything: life, history, work, whatever.
I was thinking about writing. I suppose when a lot of people sort of go for sort of a quantity for words. You know, I've written 10,000 words today, and I always just sort of think.
Yes.
I used to look at my computer and I'd say, "Well, I wrote 50."
Yeah,
but.
Oh, I'm glad that happens to other people too. That's what happens to me.
But it's not about how much you write, because every word has to go somewhere. Every sentence has to lead to the next sentence. Every paragraph has to propel whatever you're writing forward. And I just think it don't worry about how much you write, because that's totally irrelevant. It's the substance. It's what you're writing that really, really matters. If you can say something, in 200 words, but you can say it better in 50, then say it in 50.
Mm.
You know, the rest is just, it's just confetti. It's just, just writing these kind of massively packed out, that doesn't matter. And never feel, never look in someone else's lane. If someone's saying, well, I've written 20,000 words today. Well, you know what? It doesn't matter, because I wrote 50 really perfect words today.
Yeah, that's so great advice. I think you just made a lot of new friends there. I think people are going to be like, yes, because I don't know how people write 10,000 words in one day. It must just be me, but I can't do it.
I think they end up deleting them anyway.
Well, maybe that's what happens. I don't know. Lucky last question. What do you do to recharge?
I turn my laptop off. I used to, of course, obviously because I'm a musician.
Yes.
So for the most of the part, I used to just pick up my violin and play and practice, because that really does take you out of yourself. And of course, because I've been playing since I was four, so you can almost switch off your brain and just kind of go on muscle memory and your musical instinct. So that was definitely what I used to do. I haven't got my violin with me right now. So I think I do listen to music. I turn it off and I'll either put on some going back to medieval music or something soothing. That's pretty much it always comes back to music in the way. Maybe Bach if I'm feeling really, really adventurous about it.
Fabulous. I love music. Yeah. So relaxing. Now, I don't know if you've listened to any of the other episodes, but we always end with a Tudor takeaway, Lauren. So a little something for us to explore or check out after the episode. So what is your Tudor takeaway?
I think everyone should go into the British Library manuscripts catalogue, because there they literally have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of beautiful illuminated manuscripts from the medieval period, from the Tudor period as well, with fantastic summaries and quotes as well. And I could sit there all day and look at them. Those manuscripts are extraordinary. And I just think, who doesn't like those, the gold and the greens? I could do it all day. So I think everyone needs to go on. I think there's this kind of conception that maybe manuscripts are sort of tucked away in archives and they're not accessible.
Mm.
And you kind of have to really Google for the manuscripts catalogue in the British Library. Everyone needs to see these. They belong to everyone. So, and thank God they've been digitized, because it's a fantastic resource.
Oh, and they can be so much fun too. The drawings can be really, really kind of crazy.
Yeah, you've got angry rabbits and snails having existential crises. I do love it as well. True.
That's a fabulous takeaway. Thank you so much. And Lauren, we've come to the end. Thank you so much. This has been so enjoyable. And again, I can't sort of explain enough how much I love your book, and it's a must read.
Thank
must
you.
Must read for anyone.
We've been talking Thomas Boleyn, I think, since we very first met. So it's nice to finally
have
it out there.
I know, and he's so much more human now. I love it. I absolutely love it. Yes. So I appreciate it.
It's a relief.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, and I look forward to hearing about those other books when you can reveal all.
Absolutely, all will be revealed soon.
All right. Thanks again, Lauren.
Thanks, Natalie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.